tonight on Arena. Novelist Sarah Moss on her new book Ripeness and photographer Ivor Prickett on his award-winning work in Sudan. I'm Rick O'Shea. Welcome along to the programme. 51551 is our text number at RTE Arena on X. And you can watch the programme live at rte.ie/arena. Sarah Moss grew up in Manchester and has lived in Ireland since 2020. Her work includes the novels Ghost Wall, which was longlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction in 2019, and Summer Water, which is being developed as a Channel 4 series with Shirley Henderson. Recently, she published a memoir, My Good Bright Wolf. Her new novel, Ripeness, is set between 1960s Italy and contemporary Ireland and is a profound and beautiful exploration of what it means to belong. Sarah Moss now joins me in studio. Welcome to Arena.
Thank you very much.
Edith is the main character of Ripeness. Sarah, we first meet her as a 70-something divorced woman living in County Clare. Mm. Who is she?
She has a complicated background. She grew up in a farm in Derbyshire, raised mostly by her grandmother and her father, because her mother is roaming Europe trying to find her family who were Jewish in France in the 1940s. And her older sister, Lydia, is a ballet dancer, heavily pregnant and living in Italy in the 60s, or at least sent to Italy in the 60s.
Tell me a little bit about Edith living in the Burren, because your encounter of the Burren for the very first time is a probably uniquely Irish festival experience.
Yes. My own first encounter with the Burren was I was at the Ennis Book Club Festival in, I keep getting the dates wrong in the way that everything around lockdown goes blurry, but just before lockdown. And I was signing books and a woman asked me if I'd ever been to the Burren because she thought from reading my books that I would like it. And I said no, but I really wanted to go. And she said, oh, well, my friend and I go off every Sunday afternoon. Why don't you come with us this afternoon? And I checked, I had time to get to the airport, and I did. So I went off with them and we had an amazing adventure in this incredible landscape. And when they got me back to the airport, it was almost empty and everything was closing down. And when I got back to Birmingham, there were no trains because lockdown had come. And that was the end of that.
That's quite a wonderful random act of faith in people who've just come up to you for you to say, I'm going to allow you to take me away somewhere in a car.
But afterwards, I was so glad I had, because it was the last time for years I could just have gone off with strangers in a car.
Edith is, she's something of an outsider, despite the fact that she's lived in Ireland for decades. Tell me about you writing about that sense of otherness. Was that easier or hard?
It was interesting. I think I'd be suspicious of easy writing. I was interested in thinking about belonging, immigration, emigration, how you can love a place without imposing yourself on it. And Edith is English and loves the Burren. So what does it mean to be English and to love an Irish landscape? How can you do that well? And she's quite worried about that, wants to do it well.
She slightly hedges her bets as well, doesn't she? She has a number of passports.
She does. She's a perpetual wanderer. She always has an eye on the door. And that's partly about intergenerational trauma and growing up feeling as if at any moment you might have to run away.
Yeah, it's interesting that the novel moves between Edith at 73 and then Edith at 17. As a teenager, she's sent to a villa in Italy. She stays there with her pregnant sister, Lydia, until the baby is born, when it's to be given up for adoption. What drew you to Italy for this particular part of the story?
I was thinking about the Northern European discovery of the Mediterranean post-war or rediscovery. I mean, it's set in Northern Italy, which is not very Mediterranean, but that fascinated return to Europe in the years shortly after the war when travel had been impossible for a long time. And it occurs to me as I say that there's some mirroring of the return to travel after COVID as well. Of course, the sense of the world reopening and being available for exploration in a new way. And I was also very interested in dance and ballet and its relationship with writing. And I'd found a series of photos of off-duty dancers in the 50s and 60s, I mean, a little bit earlier than I've set the book, and was fascinated by the way they could command space with their bodies, even when it wasn't a stage and they weren't in costume.
How do you research a period like that? Or do you research a period like that? Or
is it a
flight of imagination based on those photographs?
Both, but there's a particular trickiness about writing set in a period that's within living memory, but not within your own living memory. I mean, back to the 80s, I'm fine because I can remember it. And back before the 40s, everybody has an equal chance of getting it right. But if you go for the late 60s, when you were born in the 70s, you need to be quite careful. And I had some older friends read it.
Someone will pull you up on that. In fact, many people will pull you up on that.
On what?
On the idea of if you get a fact wrong in something like that.
Yeah, somebody will normally tell you, but that's okay, it's fiction.
Ballet is a very beautiful motif throughout the novel. Why did you choose to make Lydia a dancer?
It was partly thinking about bodies and art and the relationship between writing and dance, because the relationships with time are so different. Dance exists only in the moment of performance, and writing is a technology of memory. So it was fascinating to get those two art forms into conversation with each other.
She's never really given into, I like the quote from here, the South Dublin lady uniform of trousers and cardigan, the colour of concrete and hair the colour of bananas. But she does try to fit in other ways. Does that make her particularly well placed as an observer of Irish culture?
Yes, I think she never tries quite hard enough to fit in. I mean, she makes slightly catty remarks like that one. She's always standing back and watching. And in some ways, that's the immigrant's move. You don't know the codes, you don't know the systems. If you've any sense, you stand back and watch while you work out how things work. But I think she forgets ever to stop standing back until she's in her 70s and divorced and moves to the Burren. And that's when she really comes into her own.
It's a discussion we had last night here on the programme about lead characters who are in their possibly 70s and beyond. There's a dearth of them certainly in modern fiction and in modern playwriting. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I mean, it might be the heritage of the Bildungsroman, which traditionally ends with some kind of achievement of adulthood, often quite early in life. And I was thinking on my way here that we don't have many depictions of happy older women.
And this book does start with her being incredibly happy.
Oh, she's very happy at the beginning and indeed in a different way at the end. But she is generally content. She has what she wants.
There's a scene in it, and it's quite a pivotal scene in the book, where she finds Maeve and she's part of the group protesting the arrival of refugees at a local hotel. This is very contemporary, and you explore the idea of belonging all the way throughout the novel. So this fits into this perfectly. Was it important to you that you wrote about this situation happening in contemporary Ireland?
Yes, because it's a book about how the waves and after effects of violence wash across the continent of Europe, east to west and back again over the decades, and about the individuals who are carried on those waves. And one of the ways that's showing up in contemporary Ireland is in the resistance to certain kinds of immigration and the acceptance of other kinds of immigration.
Because Maeve seems to have no problem in the book accommodating this idea in her head, despite the fact that that's quite a complicated one, presumably for her.
Yes, Maeve is Edith's best friend and is thinking about how difficult it is for her own children and grandchildren to find a place to live in the Burren, and resenting how easy it appears to her to be for some other people to find shelter, although of course it's not easy for them. And Edith brings a different perspective, and then there's a question about whether you can be friends with someone whose politics you don't share.
Do you think you can be?
I think some people can be. I think we all have limits and probably should.
There's a much bigger question in the book as well about belonging and about what makes somebody Irish or what makes somebody English or the labels that people use arbitrarily. I mean, Maeve discovers that she has a brother who was given up as a baby like so many others. She has an issue with the people that she's protesting against, but she has no trouble accepting him as one of her own. Those are the kind of double standards that people frequently have.
Yes, and there's often a deep and unexamined sense that belonging is genetic, that it's passed down in the blood, which can link you quite quickly to some fairly scary politics. But on the other hand, you also don't want to say, well, anybody can turn up and own anywhere. So I'm interested in ways of belonging that are about caring for landscape and people, that are about giving more than taking, or giving before taking.
I've talked to a couple of people about the book, and one of the things that's stood out is the description of childbirth in the book, because somebody had said to me that they loved the blood, the mess, the sheer work of it. The scenes where Lydia gives birth, they're genuinely affecting. Talk to me a little bit about attempting to capture that and how you go about that.
It's a book about embodiment and dance, and particularly what women's bodies do. And it was interesting to think of the choreography of a novel. And a scene where a dancer gives birth is always to some extent a scene in which she's dancing. But also I'd been a birth companion for a friend shortly after giving birth myself, and thought then that it's so strange now that unless they're professionally involved, women no longer see birth. Men see birth much more than women do. And there's something about having just done it yourself and holding the hands of someone who's doing it now that I think you know in your body in a way that you might forget later, or that someone who hasn't done it won't quite know. And that used to be such a fundamental experience for women giving birth. They would have been attended by their mothers and their sisters and their friends. And I mean, it's not that I think we should all give birth like that, but it felt quite important to have women helping women in that scene and knowing with the body.
Because a lot of fictional depictions of childbirth can be immensely sterile and can be very unlike reality.
Yes.
I'm going to ask you about Summer Water. It's been made into a Channel 4 series. Obviously, for some writers, they're very involved in the process. For some writers, they simply hand it off and say, this is nothing to do with me. How do you feel about it being brought to life? What was your involvement in it?
I'm very excited about it. I've been somewhere in between those two extremes of involvement. I read the script as it was written and was delighted to be able to contribute in small ways to small things. I've spent some time on set. I wanted it to be written and made by people who really knew what they were doing and were brilliant at it, rather than having a novelist who is absolutely not a screenwriter or a filmmaker sticking her hands in it. So mostly I've just stood back and admired and applauded, and I'm very happy with it.
Was that not a hard thing to do? I know it is for some writers I've spoken to, it's a very, very easy thing, simply because they accept themselves that, you know, it's going to be an entirely different final product. Was that easier or harder for you?
Easy and delightful, I think. It felt like having it translated. I mean, once you publish a book, it doesn't belong to you anymore. It belongs to the readers and the world. So it's another way of meeting it again.
It is lovely to talk to you this evening. And thank you so much for coming in on Arena. Ripeness is published by Picador. Sarah Moss is at the West Cork Literary Festival. You can abduct her at your will on the 16th and the 17th of July. Further details are at westcorkmusic.ie. Poets Colm Keegan and Erin Fornoff return with a new live experience, Every Blooming Thing. It's a spoken word roadshow travelling to five counties. Taking its name and ethos from Patrick Kavanagh's belief in the beauty of the everyday, Every Blooming Thing weaves together two central poems, Springshine by Keegan and A Billion Tiny Things by Fornoff, to reflect the show's grounding in positivity, hope and gratitude. And goodness knows we could do with some of that. Each stop on the tour will feature not only Colm and Erin's poetry, but local guest poets, musicians and free community writing workshops designed to celebrate local voices and encourage new ones. I am genuinely delighted to be joined here in studio by Colm Keegan and online by Erin Fornoff. Hello to both of you.
How's it going? What's the crack, Rick?
Good.
Hi, Rick.
Hello, Erin. Colm, I'm going to start with you. Every Blooming Thing is a title of hope. What inspired it? What inspired the whole ethos behind this whole roadshow?
Well, a couple of years ago, we had a great tour, another roadshow called Ireland Is, and at the centre of it was a poem that was a little bit negative, I think, and was giving Ireland a bit of a kick up the behind, you know. And it opened the door for a lot of criticism, and, you know, it was like an interrogation of the country. And then I remember thinking there was a lovely line that came from one person in particular when we were in the Everyman in Cork. Everyone was invited to say, Ireland is this, Ireland is that, you know. And someone said, Ireland, you're gorgeous, take the compliment. And that really stayed with me. And when I got the opportunity, I was invited by Live Network to submit and apply for running something similar. And I was like, I want to do it around that idea that right under, so like Kavanagh said himself, it would take a lifetime to know one field. And sometimes if you just look right down, what's around us is really what it's all about. Your family, your community, the people who take care of you. You know, sometimes we tend to point the finger out. It's like this and that and pointing the finger outwards. And we do that as well with like the things we look up to. We tend to look outwards instead of inwards, or look at ourselves and look at our families. And often there's really great and beautiful things there, you know.
And Aaron, tell me about your involvement in the project and why you felt you had to be a part of this.
Oh, well, Callum is one of my favorite people in the world, and I love we've worked on several projects together in the past, so it was, I would jump at the chance to get to work with him on anything else. And then also, I mean, keeping an eye on small joys and positivity is, you know, that's not a new concept, but I've felt the need for it more and more. Like it feels like these days, reading the news, it's almost like I have this trap door in my house and I open it every day and somebody reaches out and slaps me across the face. It's just so negative and so heartbreaking, that also being conscious of the things that we're fighting for and the things that we need to protect and the things that are our blessings and our gifts, is a way to shore ourselves up when things can feel so bleak and so difficult.
This may sound like a stupid question, but do you find people receptive to the idea of positivity?
Yeah, like I do. Like I'll go into schools and I'll say, what's happening around here? Or I'll walk with people in the workshop and say, what's going on here? What's this place like? Oh, it's a kip and nothing happens. And then you say, like, can you actually like just pay attention, write down 10 things that happened? And when you get into it, it's like, you know, one of the nicest things you ever saw was a kid wrote a poem where he noticed he was going upstairs and he looked in and he saw his grandmother helping his grandfather close the buttons on his shirt. And it's just like that stuff is actually everywhere. And that, like, it's very basic, but that's like kind of what it's all about, you know, love and looking out for each other. And at the centre of it, I think, as well as like, I've had a difficult maybe 30 to 40 was really a challenging time for me, maybe even into my 40s now, and I turned 50 this year. And I was really looked after by a lot of people. And like even now, my mother has dementia and, you know, she's in and out of hospital with different things. And there's so many people out there fighting the good fight and really making a difference in our day-to-day lives. And I think positivity, like, it's a kind of cliche. Like even myself, I was going on Instagram and trying to say, oh, you know, let's be grateful. And I was getting annoyed at myself because, like, it's like in Ireland, it feels like, what are you being grateful for? Shut your mouth, you know. But then it was like, there's a lot to be grateful for. And I think now, like, and at the centre of this, actually, there's another great influence on myself and Aaron, a great American writer called Pam Houston. And I remember talking to her a while ago and she said, I'm done with cynicism. Cynicism is the most useless thing. And positivity in the face of hopelessness is when it really matters. Like, people will say, shut your mouth being grateful. It's like, shut your mouth and get up and do something. Like, celebrate the people around you, compliment the people around you, help the people out there who are really trying to make a difference. These are challenging times. And it's like that Brecht thing, you know, what we do in the dark times, we'll sing of the dark times. But there's also, like Aaron was saying, there's something that really needs to be stood up for, defended and celebrated about what it means to be human, you know, the spirit of humanity, the joy even of like at the centre of this is a poem, Spring Shine. I wrote that poem on a random Tuesday in my house and I didn't even realise a couple of years later that house was gone. Everything had flipped and I'm so glad I saved that moment. You know, I kind of rescued a random Tuesday from oblivion and I still have it now, 10, 15 years later. And I think there's something beautiful about the fact that we can write and save these lovely moments in our lives like that, you know. And that's kind of what we're doing, going into each different town and sort of creating a unique experience on the night, because people write about their lives in that moment and share those poems on the night. And it actually, the past two gigs were really special, you know.
Maybe you'll read Springshine for us.
Yeah, actually, I don't have it with me, so I'll just do it off the bonds as such. So, Springshine. The house compacted, then opening up so fast like a popcorn kernel or a stop-motion flower, exploding with my laughter after my four-year-old son's first joke, wit like a whip crack snapping out of his mouth. In the hall, my daughter spins into her dream of being a gymnast. She flips back, she bends and unfurls herself. The room is stored with her energy. I see her aura moving through the air like slow-motion orbs of water. Her older sister has curled up on the couch, stares into her phone, opens herself as pixels, her feelings sent as letters to an invisible boy. When the tick turns green on her screen, what comes in reply is like a bomb going off in her endocrine system. She walks to the kitchen. Her mother is making spaghetti bolognese. No frills, just the sauce from a jar. Some mints. We like it simple. The steam of it on the walls, the drone of the extractor fan, the small ceremony of cutlery thrown across the table. The daughter helps and can't help smiling. The mother doesn't know why, but smiles as well. This is the soft machine of her life. Last night, the house was warm, without the fucking heating on, and this morning sunlight woke us, one by one, and the noise of a tin hurtling across the green outside, gunning a scrambler, accelerating, feeling the wind in his hair. Inside the engine, small bursts of fire, while his tyres run over the grass. In the dark beneath this all, new bulbs push hard against the clay.
That's Spring Shine by Colm Keegan. It's one half of the show. Erin, A Billion Tiny Things, your poem, is the other half. Tell us about that.
Well, Pam Houston, this American writer, has this process called glimmers, which is where you collect little moments of resonance. You could almost call it the opposite of a trigger. And you try and collect those and write them in the most visceral and full kind of way that you can. And I used to get very intimidated by having a blank notebook for writing, or I'd, you know, start in the beginning and then abandon it. So I got a new notebook, and I just started keeping track of these little moments of resonance, little nice things that happened or things that I would have noticed, or snippets of dialogue or things like that. But I would just open to a random page and put it in there. And I filled up whole notebooks doing that. And they're some of my most beloved possessions. So this 10 billion little things was really just some of those things that I put together almost as a kind of a pep talk for myself.
And maybe you perform that for us as well.
Sure. 10 billion little things. When I wake up before dawn, sand under my skin, or when the news rolls in a series of howling suffering, or when loneliness rises in me like some pale moon, I look to 10 billion little things. Small things, in there like a handful of hope prayers, like how he sings perfectly in tune with the drone of the power shower and turns his face to the water like a sigh. Or how she talks to her garden like it's her child. I add them to my 10 billion little things. Like one time I told my housemate in Dublin I miss seeing trees, and he cut dozens out of paper and stood them on a table for me. Or how my dad still wears this Houston Rockets sweatshirt from 1990, and it gets thrown away and he rescues it from the trash consistently. Or when the guy dedicated a fiddle tune to my mother and the attention made her shine a little. Or the two old men sitting in a food court playing cards next to the Panda Express, and you can tell that they just float on decades of delicious silence. I have 10 billion little things to move me. When I lived in Washington, D.C. in a house with no AC, I'd wake up in my third floor sauna and swan across the street to the all-night Safeway like some perspiring spirit. And I'd stand in the freezer aisle with the door exhaling cold and feel every moaning pore of my skin rejoice. My friend says, all you talk about is the smell of the breeze. And I say, that's right, because sometimes it's delicious. And sometimes that's what we float on, like seeds. Amid the shouting in the kitchen and the funerals and the oceans full of plastic and the great colossal cry, the 10 billion. I remember pretending to sleep, and you came in and you watched me sleep. and you brushed the hair off of my face, and it comforted me until morning came.
I still have a t-shirt from 1991 and I'm being buried in it. That's what's going to happen to that. Erin, for those people who maybe don't know your journey from the Appalachians through Barack Obama's campaign trail and then eventually to here, if you look back at all of that, do you think it unlocked certain things in you creatively that mightn't have happened otherwise?
Yeah, I mean, I think so, absolutely. The Appalachian people are storytellers, and that's what we would have grown up on. And then working for Obama, that whole campaign was designed around personal narrative and telling stories of your life to build empathy and for social change. And then moving over to Ireland, you know, the one really amazing and lovely thing about moving somewhere where you don't know a soul is that you can be whatever you want, and you're not confined by these expectations or images that people have of you or who you're supposed to be. So I wasn't really a writer before I moved to Ireland, and I credit this country for that.
What was it like engaging with the spoken word scene here in Ireland then in the very, very early days? Was that terrifying? Was that, did you find that they welcomed you in? How was that?
Oh, they were so encouraging. So, and some of those poems were very bad. But they were so, it's just such a wonderful, welcoming scene. And especially when someone's getting up there and they're new and their paper's shaking and their voice is a little stilted, it is just this aggressive encouragement. And still, I would say that Ireland is the only place in the world I've ever been where if you stood up in a pub and started to say a poem, the whole place would fall silent. That is a unique quality to this place.
I'm wondering as well, because one of the stories that I paid most attention to during the pandemic and beyond was you and the houseboat, because you lived on a houseboat for 4 years. Am I right in that?
Yeah, 4 years. And we went on, myself and a few other boaters went on, it's almost like a pilgrimage. It's called Green and Silver, which is a route that is the full length of the Grand Canal, going up the Shannon, across Lough Ree, and down the length of the Royal Canal and connecting up through Dublin. And you could do it the other way around as well. But if you complete the whole thing, you get a plaque and a certificate and a flag and stuff. And so we did that during the pandemic, because if you live in a house that moves, then you're allowed to move it around.
And your 5K moved with you wherever you were.
Right, exactly. But there, it also means there are all these lovely pubs along the canal, and I haven't been to any of them because they were all closed during our journey.
Tell me about your upcoming collection, because the last time I met you was a little over a week ago at ILF Dublin, where you were launching We Are an Archipelago. It's connected to the stage show that I was lucky enough to see at the Fringe a couple of years ago, and it suggests a focus on connection and on separation as well. Maybe tell us a bit about what inspired the title and what your readers can expect from the collection.
Yeah, so it is... it's a story told in poetry. So it's not just it's not a series of poems in a collection. It's one long story. And it is based on a real guy who was a guy named Bill, who was at the age of 99, moved back to the small island of his birth off the coast of North Carolina. And the title of it is called We Are an Archipelago, because it's about a relationship that he has with a young 22-year-old woman who is heavily pregnant, fleeing a difficult past, and the friendship that they made with a big hurricane coming, and she's, you know, nearing, very heavily pregnant, nearing birth and so on. But what's interesting about those particular islands is sometimes in storms, in, you know, moments of high pressure and storms, these islands will connect up again. The storm, the weather will turn two islands into one. And I just thought that was a really lovely metaphor.
Colm, tell me what it's like collaborating on a project like this. Is this something that you find easy, something you find hard? Is it something you seek out?
I think myself and Aaron are both products of the same scene that you mentioned. You know, back after the crash, we just kind of populated those empty, hopeless pubs where nobody had any money. And I was just thinking as Aaron was talking there, she literally taught me how to do a high five properly, like such an American thing to do. But when she's reading that poem still, there's a real joy in just how she puts a poem together. And I'm always like, yeah, like I can feel myself kind of like doing these like emotional high fives. And I just have so much respect for her work. And I love the way we can be inspired by other poets and artists in that way, you know. So it's so random that we're friends. Do you know what I mean? Like it's this kind of cosmic, like, set of circumstances that put us in a room together at the Stag's Head in Dublin at the Brown Bread Mixtape, which was facilitated or set up by Callum Ryan, a guy from exotic Waterford, you know. And there we are together. And I remember even then there was a photograph taken of myself and a few other poets, and Aaron was in the photograph as well. And we went off and did a few things, and I was always like, we should really, like, Aaron is, like, you know, the kind of the fourth musketeer. And but there's something about, like, we have a line that we like to try and make a point to say at every show, every blooming thing, is, like, we're absolute geeks about beauty. Like, we kind of geek out about those beautiful little things. Like the postscript moment of, like, the swans flying across the car in Heaney's poem, you know. It's just, like, those little things really sustain us. And it's not just the fact, like, it's when you're, we actually got the chance to collaborate and, like, world premiere in a way, you know. The two of us wrote a poem that we made especially for the show, and that's how we open the show, and then that's how we close it. So, and there's collaborating, like, just COVID is kind of like a little bit of a spectre in the room today, like we're talking about it a bit, but there was so much of people coming together to look after each other then, and there was so much where people were just, like, stepping up to do what needed to be done. And what's great about Every Blooming Thing is, like, Soft Productions are just an amazing group of people, like, who are just, they've done so, like, they're going from strength to strength, and they're going to go even further, I'd say, with what they can do as producers. And to bring people together, and to, you know, even with Lingo and stuff like that, it was always like, it's not what you want, it's the thing that adds up to the sum of everyone's best parts, you know. And that's the joy for me of collaboration, because I get inspired and pulled in new directions. And and I think this show is evidence of that. Like, so everywhere we go, you won't see the same show twice. You know, we've got Jinx Lennon coming to join us. We've got Bianca Fischel. We've got Dionne Mercury. Like, these amazing musicians that are so unique and so different to each other. And they'll just, it's like every time we put these new ingredients together to make something different and new, you know.
Tell us about where people can see this, because a couple of the shows have happened already, but already there are other ones lined up. So it's going to be, the next one up is in Virginia and Cavendish, right?
Yeah, in the Remore Arts Centre, which I read more than I say, so I hope I'm producing it right. And that's in Cavan. And then we're moving on to, we're in Roscommon as well, and the Remore Arts Centre, Roscommon Arts Centre, and we're in Longford. The backstage to finish up.
It is Longford in the middle.
Beautiful little venue, yeah. Yeah. It's one of my favourite places to go.
So that's Thursday the 5th in Virginia, Friday the 6th in Longford, and then Saturday the 7th, you're going to be in Roscommon.
Deadly. You got the order right. Thanks.
It's always one of the most important parts. In fact, some say the only important part of the job is getting that bit right at the very end. Colm Keegan and Aaron Fornough, Every Blooming Thing is the show, and thanks many to both of you for joining me.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you, Rick. Thanks.
Last month, the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting was won by a team from the New York Times, led by Irish journalist Declan Walsh and Irish photojournalist Ivor Prickett, originally from County Cork. The award was for their series of articles documenting the war in Sudan. The conflict erupted suddenly in April of 2023 and has led to countless deaths and what the UN has described as the largest displacement crisis on Earth, with an excess of 12 million people forced from their homes. The starvation crisis in the region is also profound. I am delighted to be joined by photojournalist Ivor Prickett on the line from his home in Istanbul. First off, Ivor, congratulations on the win.
Thanks so much. Yeah, it's good to talk to you.
You were a finalist for the Pulitzer before, and you've won World Press Photographer of the Year. You're no stranger really to this kind of thing. What did it feel like, though, to be part of the team that won the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting?
Yeah, obviously it was an incredible honor to be recognized along with my colleagues, including Declan, who led the team. You know, he's worked tirelessly over the last several years, really, since the war began. And we were some of the first Western journalists, let's say, to get into Sudan after the war had started last year. And, you know, we made several trips together on the ground and were part of a wider team at the New York Times who all came together to, you know, work on some pretty compelling stories last year. And, you know, it's the highest praise, really, you can get from a jury and board of your peers, essentially, in the industry. So, yeah, it feels really good. And, you know, I was just really glad, I think, that the story itself got recognized as well, because that's been one of the hardest things about covering the war in Sudan, you know, is getting people to pay attention. So to give it this extra spotlight on top of all of the coverage we did and, you know, various ways we try to reach people, this was, you know, just kind of further recognition of that.
Initially, at the beginning of this process, when the trip to Sudan was proposed, how did you feel about that?
I was really keen to go, to get the chance to go with Declan and you know, get one of the first kind of on the ground looks inside after the war had already been going on at that point for, you know, more than a year. This was last, you know, April 2024. But it was, you know, it was filled with a lot of trepidation as well, because there was so little to go on from, you know, other colleagues or other reporting, which is, it's a strange situation to be in. I'm not sure I've ever been amongst the first people to go into a conflict zone like that. So it's like going into the unknown, which is not what you want when you're in that kind of environment. But yeah, it was, you know, it was a huge task, and I was delighted to be asked to do it. And, you know, it was difficult, but really, really important trip, I would say.
I read the articles that were part of the series, the New York Times series today, and we've actually linked to some of them on our social media. It's a story that has probably stubbornly remained out of the major international headlines. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, it's definitely been hard to get people to pay attention. Like I was already saying, we've done our best to give it space, and, you know, we've been lucky to have the backing of our organization. But I think, you know, it's for a number of reasons. I would say it's a lot to do with the fact that it's been incredibly difficult to get access in the first place. I know we would have been there sooner. A lot of my colleagues would have been there sooner if it had been possible to get access in the first place, and therefore there would have been more coverage. But then, you know, on top of that, I think there's a lot of compassion fatigue when it comes to war in Sudan, war in Africa in general. Perhaps people don't want to listen, don't want to hear about it anymore. And then on top of that, you also had the war in Ukraine still going on, and then the, you know, war in Gaza that erupted in the same year that the war in Sudan had started. And those two conflicts really overshadowed Sudan, and it failed to get much of a look in, I think, until more recently.
Maybe as a photographer, explain to me, it's one of those things that I'm always most interested in. When you are in a place like this, when you're in a war zone like this, about how you interact with the people that you're photographing, because frequently they're not expecting to see a photographer, or maybe they've never interacted with a press photographer before. Mm-hmm. How does that work?
Yeah, it is. It's a very strange process. And, you know, one that I take very seriously, because very often you're dealing with vulnerable people, people caught in extreme situations, suffering, horrors in the midst of war. And so you have to treat them and the situations with the utmost respect. But at the same time, I've experienced it before in other conflicts. I've experienced it in Sudan when it's, a kind of dangerous moment. You don't always have the time that you would like to speak with people at length. But essentially, whenever I approach people and photograph people in an intimate setting, in an intimate way, I'll always talk to them first and, hear their story and ask them for permission to take their picture when possible. It's not always possible, especially in these kind of environments, but it's something I would always try and do. Mm.
One of these stories very much stands out, and we're going to put one of the pictures that was part of this award-winning series up on X and on Instagram with your permission. Tell us about 14-year-old Hassan and his mother, because I believe he made a very big impression on you.
Yeah, it was a really touching moment during our first trip to Sudan last year. We were visiting patients in the main hospital in Omdurman, the only functioning hospital in the Khartoum area, and I came across Hassan. I caught his eye through the crack, through a crack in his door. And I saw him lying in bed and went in and started speaking with his mom. He wasn't really up to talking that much, but I kind of spoke with his mom and found out a little bit about what had happened to him. He'd been shot in the stomach and he was severely malnourished as well at that point after recuperating for weeks in bed. And I asked permission to take some pictures. And while I was taking pictures, they actually brought in this meager evening meal for him. And he sat up out of his bed. And it was then that I saw how shattered he was, and I could see his ribs and his arms that were, stick thin. And I was continuing to take pictures. And at that moment, he asked me to come and actually share his meal with him. And it stopped me in my tracks because, I was already, just so horrified by the state he was in. And then I couldn't believe that he was trying to share this tiny meal with me. And, it's these kind of moments that really affect you and stay with you after the fact.
We have a second image as well, which is of a woman and her husband and children. They're fleeing famine in Darfur. What can you tell us about that image?
Yeah, I mean, that's the other side of the story, in a sense that, Darfur is some of the most kind of heavily affected parts of the country. Although it's largely inaccessible, we haven't been able to get in there ourselves to report on the ground, because the RSF, the paramilitary group who essentially started the war and are fighting against the Sudanese military, won't give access to journalists. So we're left reporting on the fringes of that in places like Chad, where I took this picture. And this was a family who I met as they were crossing the border from Sudan, from the Darfur region of Sudan into Chad, seeking refuge in a camp in Chad, along with hundreds of thousands of others. And I met them at the border and again spoke with them, asked them a little bit about where they were coming from. They were fleeing their home in Jenena, which is just across the border in Darfur, and fleeing what they said was food insecurity and, fear of violence. And they were, carrying what they could on a horse and cart. And I walked with them for 4 or 5 kilometers from the border to the camp where they were going to eventually, try and set up camp. And, again, it's in these kind of moments that you share with people and you can form some sort of connection that I think the strongest documentary photography comes from. And it's these kind of connections and moments that I'm seeking even in the midst of a breaking news situation where it's not easy to, you know, to do that. But that was definitely one of the moments where I connected with the people and I feel made a strong symbolic image.
Yourself and Declan have been back in Khartoum in recent months where the Sudanese armed forces have retaken the city. What was it like to be there? Has anything changed?
Yeah, it was very different than when we were there last year, especially in Omdurman on the, you know, on the western side of Khartoum. There were lots more people had come back. It was Ramadan while we were there, so lots of families were out and breaking, you know, fast at the end of the day, and it was like a totally different place on that side. But then the war was still going on in Khartoum itself on the other side of the Nile. And we hadn't set foot in Khartoum up until late March, a few months ago, when the military managed to take the city back from the RSF after 2 years of their control of the area. And yeah, it was a really surreal moment to cross the river and finally be able to say we were in Khartoum. And, you know, we got to the presidential palace that was retaken just a few days before, where there was a bitter fight for many many months, and it was completely in ruins, and there was still blood on the steps of the palace from the 2 days before when it was retaken, when a group of Sudanese TV journalists and the military press aides that were with them were killed in a RSF drone strike. And so, you know, it felt like a huge moment. The atmosphere was supercharged, and there was also a lot of violence going on because there was a lot of anger at what had gone on. So you could see that retribution was also already taking place, and it was quite a dangerous time at the same time.
Ivor, congratulations again, and do please stay safe as part of your work. Thanks a million for talking to us tonight on Arena.
Thanks so much.
Ivor Prickett and Declan Walsh's Pulitzer Prize award-winning articles for the New York Times on the war in Sudan can be found on nytimes.com. That's it for tonight's Arena. Paul Murnoch was on sound. The show was researched by Liam Murphy and Paula Shields. Our broadcast coordinator tonight was Ollie Hamilton. The show was produced by Sinead Egan. I'm Rick O'Shea. Join me tomorrow night from 7.